Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Josh Banday.
Tell me a story.
Tell me a fucking story! Tell me a story!
That and more. But first, I want you, yes, you, to come tell a story for an upcoming episode of Risk. It'll be just you and me having a conversation, you telling me your story. Just like the ones we've had recently with Jean-Ann LeBeck talking about sex after 70, or Nate Runkel talking about getting busted breaking into an animal testing lab as a kid. Our next one should be with you. So email me at kevin@risk-show.com and we'll get the ball rolling.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show. Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and this easy listening version of Simon and Garfunkel's Homeward Bound is coming at you from the 101 Strings Orchestra, because we're calling this episode Home. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Wendy Lee Vasquez, but to start us off, a story from Josh Banday. Josh is an actor, writer, voiceover artist, and children's book author. He told this story at our show at the Lyric Hyperion in LA last March, and there's another one of those LA Live shows coming up on September 17th. You can always get tickets at risk-show.com/live, but here's Josh Banday now with a story we call Between a Rock and a Birthplace.
So it's 4 a.m. and I am standing on my porch in front of my house, and everything is that eerie kind of quiet where you feel like you can hear the air, except there's a giant Escalade that is waiting for me with a driver in it to take me to my absolute dream role. It's a series regular spot on a new Amazon show called Upload, and I've been working for the last decade to get something like this. And I remember standing there with my wife, who's right in front of me, and we are excited and elated and a little terrified and, to be honest, abjectly sad, because we've realized that time is up and that she is going to deliver our second child and I am not going to be there. It had been an absolutely insane 9 months of pregnancy, completely different than our first kid the first time around. I mean, not only was it just because we were in the middle of lockdown, but that meant that you did, you know, the weird Zoom everything, the baby showers, we were like, oh, and then you shut it off and then you go back to making sourdough. It was, you know what I mean? It was, and then not being able to go into doctor's appointments together and waiting in the car and, you know, listening to NPR and pounding cheeseburgers just to quell the anxiety. It was insane. And just when things were at their worst, she couldn't sleep anymore. She was so uncomfortable second time around. So I would say, okay, and I'll tell you a story to help you sleep. And she'd say, oh, thank God. Okay. Giraffe. And I go, okay, giraffe. And can I have a fruit? And she'd say, pineapple. and I would improvise a story about... It is the only time improv has actually played a real role in my life that was practical. Like, otherwise, completely useless. And so, yeah, things were starting to slow down for us around this. She was a little uncomfortable. But then I get the call. I'm being asked to fly out to Vancouver on January 25th. And our due date was January 25th. And so we decided, okay, this is fine. We play that this beautiful denial game of like, what's going to be great? You know, we're going to get to that point, and then we're just going to make it happen. And, you know, who knows? She's older, and so the doctors, they fudge the dates, which they do. They do that a lot. And until we got to about 3 weeks before January 25th, everything was going to be fine. And then that 3 weeks hit, and it started to become very real. And we did what all good parents do. We went to Google. And we spent our lives there for the next 3 weeks Googling every single possible way that we could get this baby to come out. We did the massage and the acupuncture, and we prayed to the spirits, and we poured water into all the things. We had the baby making come out sex. And there's a way that you can have sex to make the babies come faster. And we're all adults here, okay? It's whatever. It's like when you're in a restaurant and you're eating, it's a little bit too late, and then people start moving the chairs. It's not like they're not putting them up. They're just encouraging you. That's kind of what this is. Too much details. But we had gotten to this point, and it was here, and we're on the front porch and just sobbing because this thing was now in our laps. And I got in the car. And the drive to the airport was about 30 minutes, but it felt like 5 years because these choices were just driving me insane. Do I just go to Vancouver? I do the thing. I make the money. I make the show. I come back and figure everything out and hope that everything's okay in my absence. Or do I just tell this driver to turn the car around and somehow walk away from all those things but be there for my family? And the driver also had a real loose understanding about how Hollywood works, despite working in LA. He was like, just call your boss. Tell him you're going to be late. I'm like, what? In what world am I going to call Greg Daniels, who made The Office, and be like, Sars, I can't come. Figure it out, y'all. Have someone clock in for me. That's not how it works. But for him, it was just very simple. And what I tried to explain was that I'd be walking away from not only this thing I'd been working for a decade to get to, but the money that would help us throughout the rest of the year and the health insurance. I'd been making videos for churches and editing their audio for the last entire lockdown just to make ends meet. We really needed this job. And so in the end, I got on a plane and I flew to Vancouver. And what follows that is this two-week really intense lockdown that Canada requires, where you gotta stay in your place, you gotta text them every day and be like, I'm still here and bored as fuck. And they track your phone and they send police randomly to your place to make sure you're there. It was intense as hell. It's probably the most intense thing Canada's ever done. Besides like curling, they get into that shit. And every day I call home and I talk to my daughter, play imaginary games with her on the phone, and I FaceTime Katie, and I tell her stories to help her sleep. And then 1 week into the quarantine, I get a phone call at 11 o'clock at night, and it's Katie, and she's like, I'm having contractions. And contractions are like that rising sound right before the beat drop, the do 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 do. It's like, that's the riser, like you're getting ready to go. And so I said, okay, let's go to, you drive to Ventura, which is where the birthing center was. And she got in a car with mother-in-law, and then a couple of hours later, I get a second phone call, and they're at the birthing center, and they're there with these wonderful two other midwives. They're very well taken care of. Mother-in-law is there. Katie is there. And everyone has that level of, we're trying to sound calm, but we're very anxious, where they're like, hey, it's just a little bit too, the pitch is too high for me to be really okay with this. And everyone's kind of hurrying, and I don't really understand what's going on, but it's because she went in and she was already 6 to 7 centimeters dilated. We're at the top of that riser. Like, we are very close. And the baby was coming very fast. So they're like, well, what do you want to do? What's going to happen? Okay. And my wife just beautifully says, tell me a story. And that's how it is in my mind. When I recounted this story to her, it was more like, tell me a fucking story. Tell me a story. And I was like, yes, okay, yes. yes, can I please have an animal? She's like, a penguin. You know, all those sounds. And I continue the story in between bouts of and finally finish it, and the baby comes out, and she's healthy and beautiful. And they fall asleep, and I hang up the phone with them, and I'm in this room by myself a million miles away. And the vacuum of that space just took me over. I felt like there was this fishing line from my chest that extended into Canada. And there was nothing I could do about it. So I just sat there. And our plan was for her to come out, and once the baby was strong enough, and meet me. And those were all just really stupid things that we thought was going to happen during a lockdown. They're like, we're not handing out passports. What are you, insane? And then Canada was just like, the lockdowns are going to get way harsher. You're going to have to stay in a weird hotel with a bunch of other people, you know, figure out your life. And so instead was 3 months of me making these phone calls and going on FaceTime and wrapping the baby in my sweatshirts and singing to her and telling her stories and imaginary and more. And so I fly home, and there's a week of quarantine that I have away from, just to be safe, because we didn't know anything at that point. So I spend a week in my friend's place doing all the same stuff. And the day arrives where they're going to come and meet me. And I had everything ready to go. I was like, here's what I'm going to do. I didn't have a car, so I'm going to walk down the street. I'm going to get flowers. Ah, thank you for the flowers. And then I'm going to go across the street from there where there's a convenience store. I'm going to pick up the little stuffed animals they like. I'm going to bring it back to the house. They will come, ding, and I'll look perfect. And everything will be great, and it's going to work out awesome. And I had about 3 hours to do this. I woke up refreshed, and I get a text on my phone. Ding. We'll be there in 15 minutes. We got a little antsy, and things kick into high gear. Like, I'm not built for speed, but I am running down the street in Studio City trying to get to a flower shop. They are not open. That's not a morning business. They open when they wanna. And I'm just like, oh my God, okay. I run across the convenience store. Very nice Iranian man rings me up and is just like, why are you buying all these children's toys? Fine, whatever. I'm not gonna ask the questions. I run across the street. The lady, the owner, is opening up the flower shop, not because they're open yet, but because, I don't know, she's going in there to like check her email or something. And I go, excuse me, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I just want to say, and I just ramble on this story. I'm pouring sweat. I have stuffed animals in my hands. I'm like, please, I just need some flowers. And she looks at me like, this man is a predator. But something gets through, and she lets me in, and she makes me the most beautiful bouquet that I have ever seen. Charged me a lot for it, but still very, very beautiful. And I'm running down the street, back to the apartment, pouring sweat, doll, flowers in my hands. I get there, I lay everything out. I'm trying to put on my bow tie. My hands are too sweaty to put on my bow tie. And I finally clip it on, knock, knock, and they open the door. And there is my family plus another human where there wasn't a human before. It's a strange feeling. So I hug all of them, the wife, and I give the presents and I give the flowers. And this is so weird. She hands me a baby. Oh, what is it? And then these last 3 months collapse onto this moment like an accordion. And I realized that I just really didn't want to be rejected by my own kid. That's what this whole thing was leading up to and what I was so worried about. And, oh, Joshua, in that moment, she smiled like, the fuck is wrong with you? What are you worried about? And it changed everything for me. Because no one else, I didn't need to be accepted by anyone else in this world. I'm crying now. There's not one decent picture of this time. I really tried to like, happy father. I'm pouring snot on this baby. She's like, fuck. And I wish I could say that things got easier. They didn't. We had to deal with postpartum depression. We had to deal with more lockdowns. We had to deal with more stuff. But having her around made the highs higher. To this day, she's this crazy three-year-old with her own timing about life. She has invited so much chaos and beauty into my life. And even though the beginning wasn't perfect, it was perfect. Thank you.
No matter what you're going through, you are never alone. Join me on my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Braithen, every Friday. Each episode is like sitting down with your best friend for a cup of coffee. From self-care tips to inspiration for healing, this podcast offers the chance to return to nature, return to community, and return to who you are at your core. Straight from my heart to yours. Listen to and follow From the Heart with Rachel Braithen on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Risk. This is Maggie Dave behind me now covering the Randy Newman song, I'll Be Home. And the singer there is Sean David Christensen, who told some extraordinary stories on Risk and once made a beautiful movie out of the story The Duel that actress Lily Taylor shared on Risk years ago. Now, the story we just heard was from Josh Banday. He is on the sitcom Not Dead Yet on ABC and Hulu, and the sci-fi comedy series Upload on Amazon. Look him up on Instagram at Josh Banday. Next, we're going to hear from Wendy Lee Vasquez, who is an advocate for people in underrepresented and undeserved communities. I'll tell you, the world needs wounded healers. And in this remarkable story, you will hear from one. Here's Wendy Lee Vasquez now with a story she calls A Tale of Two Mothers.
Sometime in late March when I was 14 years old, I came home to my mom yelling at me to come to the kitchen. My mom, Lydia, she was a pastor for so many years, and she's just really this really strong, strong lady. But I always knew when she called me Wendy, I knew I was in trouble. And so I went to meet her in the kitchen, and she asks me why I have been like cutting class and cutting school. And the truth was, I really was, but I told her I didn't, of course. Told her I didn't. And she's like, I know you've been doing this. Why have you been doing this? Why have you been cutting class? And I'm like, no, I haven't, you know, trying to save my own ass. Because I knew what was coming was a beating. She had the broomstick in her hand. On top of that, while I'm talking to her, she lifts up this book. And there's a bunch of like white printer pages stapled together. And it's my book of poetry. And she lifts this up and she says, you just say these bad words, these curse words in your book, and you don't want to go to school. The truth is, I wasn't going to school because I wasn't really allowed to hang out with other kids outside of my nieces and nephews, to be very honest. So my mom, she gets the broomstick in her hand and she's ready. And I know what it is because she's tightening her grip on this thing. I know she's about to beat me with this broomstick. But I was... In that moment, I really wasn't focused on the broomstick. I was focused on, like, betrayed. I felt betrayed because That was my personal book of how I felt, and she's never really asked me how I felt. She adopted me when I was 12, but she's had me since I was a year and a half old. So Lydia has been like almost the only person I know as a mother to me, even though I know that I do have a birth mom. So right when she was like lifting her hand up with the broomstick, ready to come down on my head, the phone rings. And my sister passes her the phone, and it's a lady from church. And she's in some type of crisis. And my mom, as the leader of the church, has to dash out in a second. And so she puts the broom down and she's like, okay, we're going to get to this later. I went up to my room and I sat and I contemplated on what to do. What to do, what to do, what to do. Well, a part of me feels like my mom understood that I was angry about being adopted. I don't think she really understood my feelings towards it deep down. And so it was very hard to live in that world. I decided I want to run away. I was tired of getting my ass whooped all the time. I was tired of not being understood. I never felt like I had a home. Running away wasn't just about running away. It was about trying to find myself, trying to find my home. So I packed my little string bag, a couple of pieces of clothes in there. And I decided that in the morning, I was going to go to school and ask Tati, my good friend Tati, to help me escape this like house. The morning comes, she calls us for school. I go to school and I look for my friend Tati. And I say, Tati, listen, my mom is just pissing me off. I want to leave from here. I want to call my brother Jason, and I want to go live with him. You see, it wasn't so far-fetched that I was so compelled to run away, because a few years earlier, my brother Jason had done the same thing. The school day went by, and, you know, we sat, we talked, we had lunch, we cut class. Me and Tati meet up in front of the school, and then we head on the train to our house. Before we get into our house, I say, Tati, I also need blonde hair dye because I want to dye my hair blonde so that no one will see me. I thought that by dyeing my hair blonde, no one would notice it was me. I was ahead of the game. There's this part of me that's like, I'm so thrilled. I feel like a badass, to be honest. I'm escaping somewhere that I don't want to be. So I really felt thrilled in the sense of like, I felt like a badass, like a true badass. We walk down the block and we get to Tati's house. Tati tells me that we have to enter through the basement because she doesn't want her parents to know that I'm there. So that's what we do. We enter to the basement. I enter to this like all white basement with a room bedroom down there and a little like gathering space and a bathroom. Tati passes me her phone. From there, I call my brother Jason and I say, Jason, I don't want to stay here anymore. I don't want to be with my mom. I just want to leave. I'm stressed. I'm ready to go. And he's just like, don't worry. I'm going to take good care of you. And we agree to meet at 8 o'clock at the nearby train station. A little time goes by. Tati dyes my hair. And we're talking and chit-chatting like girls do. And then the doorbell rings. And I can hear Tati's parents opening the door. I hear the person say that they are a police officer. I panicked because I just felt that if I go back home, I was gonna get my butt whooped, and I didn't want that. And so Tati's like, go in the closet. There's a closet in this basement, the living area. And when she opens it, it's all these blankets, like heavy blankets, just a sea of quilts in this closet. And she's like, hide under the quilts. And I was like, say no more. And I went in there and I hid under the quilts. And from there, I heard the officer ask for Tati. Tati's mom calls her from upstairs. I hear, Tati, Tati. Tati goes upstairs. I hear the cops say, do you know where Wendy's at? And Tati says, no. And they asked her, was she acting strange today? Did she say anything out of the norm? And Tati's like, no, I don't know. I didn't hear her say anything strange today. It was just a normal day. And then I hear my sister. and she says, "I'm looking for my sister." And I heard my mom's voice upstairs, and my heart crushed because it was probably one of those first times that I actually heard my sister, Adi, say, you know, "This is my sister." Not that they never called me that, but it was the first time I realized, oh, yeah, I'm a sister. But anyways, I hear my mom talking, and I hear my sister asking about if she knows anything, and, you know, Tati's just saying no. I'm still in this closet, and I'm sweating up like, it's like a steam shower in there. It's just really hot, and I just want to go because the blankets were just really too much. But anyways, the cops leave, and Tati comes back downstairs, and she's like, "Okay, they left. You could come out." And I went out. Luckily, her parents never came down. And then I want to say about like 20 minutes later, the phone rings and it's my brother. And he says, "Hey, I'm at the train station." It was one of those outdoor trains. Can't remember the actual number of the line, but I remember it was outside. And as I looked from the bottom of the stairs and looked up, I just saw this tall tree of a white guy with red hair. My brother Jason, who's 6'7". That's what I saw. And so, you know, I give Tati a hug and I say, "Thank you so much for helping me out." And she's like, "No problem. Let me know if you need anything." I run up the train steps to see Jason. I give him a hug. And it just felt so good to be reunited with my blood relative. We get on the train and I tell him everything that's happened to me. We get to Queens and he walks me over to the house that he's staying at. I walk inside and I can tell that it's dated because they have all these like old school china cabinets. We go downstairs to the basement because at the time that's where he was staying. And he introduces me to his wife, Carmen. He just tells me this thing how, "Oh, we're going to live together. It's going to be great. I'm going to take custody of you. And, you know, you don't ever have to worry about going back to anyone else." And I'm just like, yeah, you know, I was on cloud nine, to be honest, because I wanted to just be a kid. I wanted to explore who I was. And I wasn't allowed to do that there. Jason shows me to the bathroom and he says, "You know, like, that's the shower. That's where you're going to shower. For right now, you're going to sleep here. And there's like this little pull-out cot bed thingy. And that's where I sleep on." Small backstory is that Jason and I got taken away from our biological mother, Mabel's house. And we were sent to live in my adopted mother's house. During our time with my adopted mom, Jason wasn't the nicest person. But more importantly, Jason kept running away from home. So the last time he ran away from home, the social worker tried to bring him back to the house. But my adopted mom, Lydia, said no. And then Jason winded up in the group home. Coming back to the present, Jason goes down to family court and gets temporary custody of me. A small part of me felt like I was doing something wrong. This was my mom. And while she wasn't my blood mom, she raised me, and I did love her tremendously, and I still do. But then there was this other part of me that felt I was doing something right. I was advocating for myself because, really, I didn't have anyone to advocate for me. Jason comes back home later on that evening, and I'm sitting down watching TV, and he says, "I did it. I handed her those papers in her face, and I'm going to get custody of you. I let her know I'm getting custody of you." As he was saying that, I heard spitefulness in his voice and I saw it in his face. It's like he wanted to get back and take a jab at her. In that moment, I started to feel really bad because while I was justified in the reasoning behind why I wanted to run away and my feelings of how she made me feel, I didn't want my brother to do that. Because the one thing I could say about my adopted mom, Lydia, is that while she whipped my ass and I didn't feel like I had a safe space to express how I felt, I always had what I needed. She always made sure that I was well educated. And she always made sure to help me understand what it is to be a woman. As the months go on living with Jason, I start to begin to see the cracks in him. He's a deceiver, a liar. One of the things he lied to me about was my biological mom, Mabel. After living with him, I started to ask him to see her. I saw my biological mom up until the age of 6. At that point, they realized that she would never get better enough to take care of her kids. She was into drugs and a lot of different things. She was very, very, very mentally not healthy, I would say that. They took away her rights from seeing me. So after 6 years old, I never see my mother again. Living with Jason, I will always say, Jason, please, I would love to see our mom. And he'll always bring up all these excuses. Oh, you can't. Oh, she's doing this. I don't really know where she's at. All these lies. One day, during this time period, Carmen, his wife, who was a home health aide at the time, came to me and said, Wendy, I think I'm taking care of your mother. I asked her what she meant. And she said, well, there's this lady in Queens. I take care of her. Her name is Mabel Fredericks. She has one leg amputated. And she keeps asking to see her kids so that she could ask for forgiveness. So then at that point, I tell Jason, listen, I know that Carmen is taking care of mom and I want to see her. I want her to be able to see our mom so I could forgive her and that I could give her just a little bit of love. Because even though Mabel couldn't take care of me, she was still a part of me. Jason never forgave our mom, Mabel. To be fair, our mom used to beat the shit out of him. My mom was just a very tough lady. She took a lot of drugs, so she wasn't really there all the time mentally. I try to explain to Jason that he has to learn forgiveness. I think that really bothered Jason a lot. For me to say out loud, I forgive our mother. He prevented me from seeing her and giving me her address. A few days later, Jason just bust into the room and he's like, oh, I need you to go over to your friend Brittany's house. Ask her if you could stay there. I'm going through stuff with my in-laws because we lived in the basement with our in-laws. So that night, I went over to Brittany's. Jason went with me and dropped me off, said he will call me when he's ready to pick me up. Weeks go by and I don't really hear much from Jason. He calls every once in a while. Every time he called, he will say, yes, I'm going to go get full custody of you. You know, I'm just looking for a house for us so that me, you, and Carmen can live together. So don't worry, I'll be there for you. What Jason didn't tell me at the time was that he wasn't working and he definitely wasn't trying to find us a house. One day, Rachel, Brittany's mom, calls me to the room and says, Wendy, I have to tell you something. Your brother just called. I just got off the phone with him. He says that your mom died. When I heard those words come out of Rachel's mouth, I felt gut punched. I felt like my heart was broken in gazillion of pieces. I felt like a chance was taken away from me. And not because there was no opportunity, but because my brother was so spiteful that he didn't even want me to have a relationship with my mother. It's kind of funny when I say it out loud, because when I look back, it's like he kind of didn't want me to have a relationship with either mother, my biological mother, Mabel, or my adopted mother, Lydia. The person who took it all away from me was my brother, Jason. And I never looked at him the same after that. Later on that evening, I get a call from Jason and I'm crying over the phone and yelling at him. And I'm saying, why didn't you tell me our mom was dying? And you knew how much I wanted to talk to her and you didn't give me a chance to talk to her, to have forgiveness with her. He then proceeds to tell me that, oh, no one cared about her. No one even showed up to her funeral. Like, I don't even know where she's buried at. Which devastated me even more. Because no matter how much crazy things people do in their life, no one deserves to be alone in death. She didn't deserve that. As the conversation proceeded, Jason began to tell me he's coming to pick me up soon. Days go by, and I still haven't heard from Jason. It wound up being that, like, he actually just dropped me off at a friend's house and never came back for me. Because I never saw Jason again after that. The living situation at my friend's house also deteriorated, and I had to move from there. At that point, I went to house until I ended up in Iroquois Job Corps in Medina, New York. Job Corps is a youth development program where students could get their GED or high school diploma and could also get a trade as well, too. Job Corps also provided young people with housing. It also set me on the path of opening up my mind to the other possibilities in life, like going to college. So at that time, Job Corps really was the most stable thing in my life. I've always felt like I was searching for my home. I still, for some weird reason, don't feel like I belong. In fact, I don't think I ever truly felt like I belonged anywhere. Maybe it's just me. And to this day, I still haven't found my home. I don't know what a home will look like to me. I still haven't found a place where I can sit down and say, yeah, this is where I belong. And maybe the trauma from, like, after my mom dying and Jason just disappearing and me going from different location to different location is affecting that in some way. But I really hope to God that one day I find my home.
This is Risk. This is Depeche Mode behind me now. And we just heard from Wendy Lee Vasquez. She said, I currently spend most of my time working with at-risk youth who have similar backgrounds to me. And you can find her on Instagram at Wendy_Wen_Vasquez. Folks, a Risk fan recently made a one-time donation to the podcast by going to paypal.me/riskshow and sent me a beautiful message. There's a line there on PayPal that says, "What's this donation for?" And this donor said, "For making life worthwhile and knowing I'm not alone in daily struggles. I work as an ICU nurse, so I see some crazy things. I'm making this donation on behalf of a transgender patient who tried to kill themselves. Please keep the show going. I've been listening to your show for years and years, and we need you. We need this show." Well, I'll tell you, In the conversations I have with people about what I do, I almost always end up referring to the messages like this one that make the show, I mean, even no matter our financial struggles, getting messages like that is so, it's such a morale booster. Also, about 14 years ago, when I was first starting Risk, I was so concerned about making no money making the show that I applied for subsidized artist housing in New York City. And this week, my name was finally called. I don't know how it works exactly, but they finally got back to me 14 years later. I mean, it hasn't just been, how are we going to keep Risk running? It's been, how is Kevin going to continue being able to live in the ever more expensive New York City that I've somehow managed to find a way to live in for 36 years, but it's getting crazy. And I'm pretty sure that what went a long way toward my getting accepted was the essay I wrote about the art I create, and including quotes from fan mail, like that one, like the one we just heard, making the point that yes, some art is profoundly important, even if it doesn't get wide recognition all throughout the entertainment industry or make people rich. So, if you want to help keep Risk running, help us out over at patreon.com/risk, where there's lots of bonus content. Or like the person who wrote that email I just read, you can make a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. Well, that's about it for this episode, folks. But come back on Thursday when we'll be rerunning a couple of truly lovely stories in the Best of Love Stories number 2. That'll be on Thursday. Whereas, folks, today's the day. Take a risk.